Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Johnson Chiama Graduate School of Public Policy. My name is Jeremy Raynor, and it's entirely in keeping with the one school, two campuses approach to the JSGS that I should be introducing our distinguished guest speaker today, because I'm, of course, from the University of Saskatchewan campus, the Centennial Research Chair in the school. But as many of you know, I was for some years down here at Science. This is the first in our series of four lectures on the topic of policy change. And I hope we'll see everyone at the next and subsequent lectures in this particular series. Our guest today, a very distinguished political scientist, is Professor Brian Jones, who is the J.J. Jake Pickle Regents Chair in Congressional Studies in the Department of Government, University of Texas at Austin. To a political scientist, Professor Jones would need no introduction at all. His name is very, very well known in the discipline, mainly for work, I think, that he did during the many years that he spent at the University of Washington in Seattle. But he has now moved back closer, I understand, to his roots, to the University of Texas at Austin, where some years ago, shall we say, he completed his dissertation. Rather than summarize chronologically his achievements and contributions, which will take far too long, maybe I could just put what he has done in the context of this lecture series on policy change. Policy change, I think, has three large questions that have to be answered if we're to make any progress on understanding it. The first, oddly, is the one that's least well addressed in the literature, and that's simply what it is. Neither policy nor change are simple concepts, and many, many studies, I think, have been derailed by not paying attention to what it is that they're trying to explain, and excluding the things that they're not trying to explain. And certainly, Professor Jones's work has shown what can be achieved if you are very careful about the dependent variable in your model of policy change. Secondly, there's the questions around the how and the why, which is what most people are interested in connection with policy change. Is it possible to say anything of a general nature about the causes of policy change and the patterns of change that we observe? And there, Professor Jones has for a long time been associated with something called the Policy Agendas Project, which I believe is still running, very, very vital the last time I saw it, in which he is concerned to trace the connections between the changing nature of the policy agenda and what happens further down the line in the policy process. Two innovations, I think, that he has introduced to our study of policy change here. One is to be very, very careful about the behavioral foundations of decision making. This really is what his lecture is about today. The behavioral foundations of decision making are obviously crucial to understanding policy change. Why do people decide to change or not to change? But in addition, he is also very well known for the theory that for long periods of time, policy rarely changes at all, or changes very little, and is then punctuated by very rapid and drastic changes before returning to an equilibrium position. And this theory of punctuated equilibrium, the term is borrowed from paleobiology, and is used as a theory, as many of you may know, about to explain gaps in the fossil record. That has been applied with great success to understanding policy change. And finally, the so what question, the question that most policy practitioners want to know: how does this help me manage policy change, to promote change if those are my instructions, or indeed to prevent undesirable change? And there, again, Professor Jones has led by innovative and important studies of particular policies and policy areas, most notably budgeting. He is an expert on the congressional budget process, a topic of great importance right now, as you've been following the news. And His work there, I think, has been widely used by practitioners to understand the dynamics of budgeting. It's with great pleasure that we have him here today to talk to us. And the title of his talk is Human Nature and Public Policy, Behavioural Foundations and Policy Studies. Please join with me in welcoming Professor Jones.
Thank you very much for inviting me here to learn about this very interesting organization that you have set up here, two campuses, one school. It's going to take a lot of management to make this work, but I'm very impressed with what I've seen so far. And thank Jeremy for that introduction, and let me mention before I start the Policy Agendas Project. It's a big database project now located at the University of Texas. Policyagendas.org. You can go to these this data set if you're interested in comparative politics, the U.S. in particular, and these data can be accessed for no charge and in fairly easy fashion, we hope. Okay, today I am going to talk about the behavioral foundations of public policy, and I do so under the urging of Michael, who asked me to focus on this, and I was glad to return to it. So give me a chance to rethink some of the things that I've been writing over the years. And I'm happy to say I gave a similar talk to the social psychologist at the University of Texas, and he's got some of the bugs out of it. So I hope this will go a little better than talking to them. Here's what I want to do today. I want to review the basic developments of behavioral rationality and policy studies. Assess the current shortcomings of the approach as it stands now, and finally lay out some recent developments in the field, in particular discussing where I think we're most weak in understanding policy change, and that's regarding policy feedback and what I'm going to introduce a concept today called policy bubbles, and we'll see what you think of them. And some extensions of a concept that is old that I developed a number of years ago, disproportionate information processing. All right. Here's the basic problem. To understand the operation of policymaking processes, we need a model of human behavior. And we need a model of human behavior because organizations mimic the raw material with which they're built. Something Herbert Simon, the founder of bounded rationality, was fond of saying. You can't have an organization that makes any sense if you don't build human nature into it. The model that we use can't be overly detailed. If it is, then we become psychologists and not students of the policy process. But it must abstract out the most prominent and relevant parts of a model of human behavior, and that's the hard part. And all of the social sciences share this issue in contrast to the behavioral sciences. Economic, sociology, and political science all face this problem and all have handled it in somewhat different ways. We won't talk about much of that today, but I will talk a lot about political science and public policy. Okay. What is bounded rationality and behavioral rationality? The concept of bounded rationality was initially defined by Herb Simon in his book Administrative Behavior, written in 1945. As a critique of studies of organizations based in rational choice. Go back that far, and even I don't, but if you did, you would find a literature in organization dynamics centered in time and motion studies, how business organizations work, based on applying rational principles to the management of production lines and things like that. Herb Simon wrote a book, it's still very accessible, it's still very relevant, Administrative Behavior. One of the reasons this book was so important is it's so easy to read. There's a critique of organizational dynamics at the time, and it brought the limits of rational action to the fore. So look, you can't understand organizations without these understanding how limited people are in dealing with full-blown rationality. That's why I call it bounded rationality. Unfortunately, it did not at the time include a positive model of choice. So you can show what the limits are, but you can't show what's going on unless you know have a more positive model of choice. And that's what he called behavioral rationality, again from Herb Simon. It's a positive model of choice, drawing on the principles of biology and psychology to assess the role of human cognition and emotion on decision-making processes. So what is it that you need about understanding human cognitive behavior to understand the operation of organizations, or in our case, the policy process? I want to distinguish between, I better not walk too far, I'm a terrible wanderer when I give a talk, and I wander right outside of the camera, and I suppose the folks in Saskatoon can no longer see me, but that may be a good thing. They can still hear me, I hope. Procedural rationality. Procedural rationality, what I mean by that is procedural behavioral rationality, kind of PBH I call it. It concerns the process by which people make decisions, and it always has a biological basis. For example, humans have limited attention spans. And we know that, well, this is coming to the fore big time now, because in the United States, you probably have this in Canada too, drivers going down the road texting and talking on the phone and having all sorts of fun. And the texters have accidents at the same rate as dead drunk drivers do. And why? It doesn't matter whether they're shifting their attentions around. The guys on the phone, they don't have accidents at the same rate as dead drunks, but you know, a little bit of alcohol, it's still a very dangerous thing to do. And it doesn't matter whether you've got, you're talking on the phone like this, or you've got a speaker in the car. Why? Because you're losing your attention span. You can only pay attention to one thing at a time. That's biological. I don't care how many times people tell me they can multitask. They can't. But you're always shifting from one stream of information to another. That's what I mean by procedural rationality. And I think there's a good literature to show how that influences the choices that people make in life and politics and elsewhere. And then I distinguish between that and substantive behavioral rationality. And these are elements of behavioral rationality, that human cognition, that directly affects the choice of goals, and they may or may not have a basis, a biological basis. For example, there's a lot of literature. Lynn Ostrom, who has worked a great deal in this area, has found a norm of fairness in her studies of interactions of people allocating collective goods. And lots of other people have too. This norm of fairness is very robust, but I don't see how it has a biological basis, nor does it affect the process of making a choice. It ends up affecting the outcomes, the choice of goals. Well, I don't want to do that because it's not fair. It's different, but I can't do that because of my attention span. I focus most of my work on the former set of questions, and will continue to do so today. Okay, let's talk a little bit about where bounded rationality came from and how it's developed over time. After Herb developed his work in the late 40s, political scientists picked up the strand and began to think through how this might affect political choices. And the most important part of this came to fruition in the late 50s and early 60s with the work of Charles Lindbloom, Aaron Wadowski, and Richard Fenno. And these scholars focused on the inability of policymakers to maximize goals due to the interaction between cognitive abilities and complexity of the environment. This is the key problem of behavioral rationality: how cognitive limits and complex environments interact and what the consequences are. If we were fully rational, we wouldn't have any trouble with a complex environment. We have tools to deal with that. Behavioral rationality implies that we have trouble dealing with complex environments. And that's what these early bounded rationalists stressed. In particular, they stressed the use of heuristic decision rules, another very important concept from Simon, that ensured stability. So if the environment is complex and you have to simplify it, maybe the best way to do that is to develop some simple decision rules that codify interaction among complex parts in the environment. In particular, budget decision rules. So if you go back to and examine Aaron Wadowski's Politics of the Budgetary Process, you'll see a lot of the emergence of norms and rules, go back to substantive deprocess in this case, that structure the interaction among the parts and allocate resources when it's time to do that. The budget studies of Waldowski drop a decision rule to a simple maximum. Grant to an agency some fixed mean percentage of that agency's base budget, plus or minus some stochastic adjustment to take account of special circumstances. So if the parks budget needs to be increased a little bit because you cut them last year, you increase it a little bit. That's fair share. Base and fair share, those are the keys. If the crime rate's gone up somewhat, the police guy gets a little more money. That's the idea. The adjustment process is adaptive and it responds to the environment that way. The models of Waldowski and colleagues were quite successful at first glance in modeling budget changes based on these simple rules. But it was important work and it's still critical to our understanding of budget processes. But the critiques of the model and its estimation centered on some methodological problems with the regression analyses that these scholars used, claiming they overestimated incrementalism. Most importantly, a scholar named John Padgett of the University of Chicago showed that a stochastic process model of incrementalism led to a normal distribution of first budget differences. That's a bunch of technical terms for saying changes in budgets over time are not normal. Incrementalism implies that they are. Okay? Now, incrementalism implies that they are because if you go back to the original specification here, you just draw out a stochastic term to model the changes from one year to another. So it doesn't get very far out of line. You don't have any huge budget changes or huge increases or huge cuts. So Padgett says, look, here's the implications here. You've got to find a normal distribution, like heights or IQs, of budget changes over time. And if you don't, it's not incrementalism. He had some data that suggested that this probably wasn't the case. But we followed up on it, my colleagues Jim True and Frank Baumgartner and I. I want to show you one picture here. It's the only picture in the whole... No, I got other pictures. But this is the only chart that I'll show here. This is the death knell of incrementalism, I claim, because it is a graph of the year-to-year changes in budget categories in the United States budget from 1947 to 2006, whenever I did this chart, 2003. It won't change in distribution across categories. So you got Social Security time one minus Social Security time two minus Social Security time one as a percent of the earlier number. That ought to be normal if that's an incremental budget process. And you can clearly see that it's not. The dotted line is a normal curve that's associated with those budget changes, same mean and variance. And you can see that there's way, way too many cases that are too small in the middle, very little, almost zero change. And there's way, way too many that are too big, especially on the upside. And there are too few that are moderate adjustments. So instead of that police commissioner getting a stochastic adjustment, he either gets a small adjustment like he did before, almost no change, or a huge one. Why? Because some premier in Saskatchewan decides it's time to crack down on crime, and he dumps a bunch of money. Yeah, I just read that in the paper today. It looks like exactly what we know experience as public servants in the budget process. All of a sudden, somebody's going to talk about crime and going, we're going to have to struggle to figure out how to spend that much money in an efficient way that you're going to dump on us because we had good crop prices this year, whatever, and the taxes came in. Anyway, so that's the way budget changes work. They don't behave as simply and as smoothly as Waldowski and colleagues suggest. So, stage one. The original bounded rationalist. Stage two, critiques of the incremental model. that came from the heuristic decision rule approach. Stage three, more positive models of how budget changes work. Budgets, in a word, have been the most important test area for the theory, behavioral theories of choice. So I'm not going to talk about this, but John Padgett developed a serial processing model, which is deeply based in bounded rationality. And Frank Baumgartner and I, developed this punctuated equilibrium model, which Jeremy briefly described, which implies occasional large-scale policy changes against a backdrop of incremental changes. And you can see that this distribution is consistent with that. Doesn't prove it, it's consistent. Mostly small changes, occasional big changes. That's consistent with the punctuated equilibrium model. Both have behavioral rationality as foundations. Okay, to proceed any further, I want to introduce on this same slide, which is a little bit inefficient, but too many slides, too many different changes. I call this the fundamental premise of behavioral organization theory. So we're looking at budgets in the aggregate. Behavioral rationality is a theory of how individuals behave. So how do we connect the two? I wrote this once, so I'm going to have to quote myself here. I still like this thing. I don't know how I came up with it, but once in a while, it's like, I suppose, pride of ownership, pride of authorship. Human organizations fall prey to canalization of behavior in the same one that human decision makers do. And the relationship is not metaphorical, it's causal. Okay, so that means whatever we view in human behavior has probably got an analog at the organizational level. Most importantly, there is, I've got a slide on this, I can't remember. Let me say this and then go follow it up in just a second. The attention spans that I've discussed before have an analog in organizations, and that's the agenda of the organization. What's the organization taking seriously? What is it focusing on? Is it crime or health, foreign policy, crop prices? What is it? What's the concern? Now, we have ways of handling in parallel, to some extent, the limitations of our own attention spans. So we hire experts in healthcare to follow, healthcare analysts, or in crime, and budget experts in those areas. But at some point, the premier and the cabinet have got to focus on that problem. And once they focus on that problem, they're excluding other ones. That's the key. And that's the organization's agenda. Now, attention is critical in understanding how policymaking works. Don't understand how collective attention is allocated, I don't think we can understand the process of policy making very well. Fundamental models of human choice within complex environments is how attention to incoming information streams is allocated. Attention must be allocated in a disjoint fashion. It cannot be allocated proportionally to income streams. Similarly, with organizational agendas. As information comes in, we've got to pay attention to different information streams, so has the organization. It's got to pick out what it wants to respond to. And as a consequence, you get disjoint and episodic agenda changes. It's not smooth. Either you're doing nothing in the area or you're doing one heck of a lot. I like this. Told you there'd be another picture. Paul Nouget was a Belgian surrealist. We only see things that we're interested in seeing, although we may occasionally develop an interest that makes us discover something we've been familiar with for years. All of a sudden, we see the train coming out of that's a Magritte painting of the fireplace. Jeez, I never noticed that before. We have a term for it in politics. Gosh, that was off the radar. Nobody could have predicted the train coming out of the fireplace, but it was probably there in plain sight. We added to this model a friction or resistance model, in which information, so we're trying to understand this disjoint process in organizational terms. That's what this is about. That's what this slide's about. That whatever happens can't happen smoothly, in part because of these factors, this friction coefficient, this friction idea. Three sources of friction. One is just pure economics. It costs you something to go search out new solutions. The other two are psychological and political. Cognitive costs, behavioral rationality, you got to get people to focus on the new problem. What are the cognitive costs of giving up an old problem and moving to a new one? What are the costs of giving up an old solution, even harder, and moving to a new one? Decision costs, those are costs imposed by institutional rules. In the United States, you well know that we have lots of institutional rules to slow down action. But we don't think it slows down action. We think it leads to a dynamic we call stick-slip dynamic. We stole that from earthquakes. I lived in Washington for a while, Seattle, and used to earthquakes. So the idea of stick-slip dynamics is something that when it's under pressure, two plates theory of plate tectonics, they don't move because the friction of the plates are holding things together. Unless the pressure builds up from the Earth's core enough, then you get a jump. You don't get a smooth change, you get a jump, and that's the earthquake. We think politics works like earthquakes that way. The information comes in, it's telling us to do something. There are implications. Yet because of our cognitive costs, because of decision costs, because of search costs, we don't move. We don't pay attention to it. The highest cognitive cost is borne by having to change our attention from one thing to another. That's why visibility of the problem is so important. When we see something very visible, we're more likely to shift our attention to that visible object. My favorite example of that, although there is plenty of them, you can come up with plenty yourself, is the Abu Ghraib scandal in Iraq, in the prisons of Iraq, when some CIA contractors, some, and even military in the prisons of Iraq were using, let us say, excess force in dealing with prisoners. The soldiers were writing home to their parents saying, something's wrong here. They would write their congressmen. The parents were connecting to congressmen. Some of the newspapers picked this up. It was not a secret. I read it beforehand. And then all of a sudden we get the movies, pictures of this that get leaked. And everybody's scrambling all over themselves to deal with the crisis. That's visibility. That shift of attention caused by this visibility dynamic. There's plenty of empirical evidence that we've amassed, and I'm not going into that right now, on showing that this friction model not only holds in the United States, but in similar studies of Belgium and Denmark, where we have similar data sets right now. And by the way, there's a Canadian agenda setting study too at the University of Montreal. All right, stage four. So where are we? Information comes in. The agenda of the organization under-adjusts to that information. Then it over-adjusts to it as the information builds up, and you can no longer ignore it. That's the simple model. That doesn't go far enough. So I'm going to lay out today, this is where I quit summarizing and start talking some new material. But where I don't think we understand the processes very well. The first thing that we do understand this, but there are not many studies of it, the existence of positive feedback systems. A positive feedback system is one in which an input goes into a system and then it gets amplified. Lots of systems don't work that way. They work by when an input comes in, the system responds to it, which damps down the strength of the input signal. Supply and demand in economics, a thermostat on the wall, all of these are positive feedback systems. So the policy would only differ in a little bit of a range. Incrementalism is like a negative feedback system. Because you get that stochastic process thing always adjusting. Positive feedback systems is when they feed in themselves on themselves, like a bandwagon effect or an economic bubble. And that's what we don't understand very well in policy. A key component, which sociologists have studied quite a bit, is a contagion effect, where people mimic one another in what they wear, what they say, what they think, because they treat other people as relevant units for trying to both improve their own information and gain acceptance in a group. And if we ignore that group dynamic in politics and public policy, we're missing something. All of a sudden, everybody's talking about the same idea. All of a sudden, all the students on campus wear the same clothes. At the University of Texas now, it's an indicator of climate change, I think. All the students now wear Nike shorts. That's what they wear to class. Geez, I can't even remember when they wore blue jeans just a few years ago. But it's too hot for that. So they come in shorts and flip-flop t-shirts. That's the standard. And it's not just any kind of shorts. It's always Nike athletic shorts. That's what is incredible to me. So there's this mimicking going on that someday will probably break and they'll go to something else. All right. Contagion and positive feedback effects are the part of the policy process we don't understand very well. I'm going to introduce an idea here to try to see if we can get some leverage on this notion of a policy bubble. I define a policy bubble as a policy-making system that's seized by a single set of ideas that justify a more or consistent, or more or less consistent, and reinforcing course of action. So it's not enough to say, well, the conservatives are in charge and they're imposing an ideology. They have a different ideology from the liberals or here at NDP. There's a reinforcing quality to it, so that you get more and more action instead of there being a dampening effect as people sort of feel, well, we've got enough of that. Let's turn to the other side. In the United States, and a wonderful book by Stu Soroka of McGill and Chris Blasian of Temple University in the United States show that this thermostat effect works with regard to budgets in England, the United States, and Canada. So as people become more liberal, let me turn that around. As policymaking becomes more liberal, the population becomes more conservative, causing this general overall positive or negative feedback effect, so that nothing gets too far out of line. The problem with that is sometimes you have a policy bubble that can wreck the simple calculations, and there's some work done in England to suggest that, in fact, policy bubbles like this do occur, although you can call them that. Researchers do call them. Now, a policy bubble, unlike an economic bubble, doesn't necessarily bring harm. It could do a lot of good. It could be positive reinforcing, positive in the sense of beneficial, not positive in the sense of feedback and feeding into itself. Or it can be based on a really bad idea. So you get a decline in the quality of policymaking and the quality of lives of citizens because this idea has gotten lodged in politics. Whether it's good or bad almost always oversupplies. And anything that's really good, there can be too much of it. We can pay too much for it. There's a consequence. It can be inefficient. Okay. Now, that's policy consequences. I'm going to isolate two examples, and I'm sure glad I chose these two coming to Canada, especially the second one, of what I think were U.S. policy bubbles. I just started thinking about this. I'd worked on one before, the crime one, but I never thought about it quite in these terms, and I'm intrigued to see what you think. All right, first thing, environment. I claim that from about 1970 till about 1992, through that period of time, the U.S. experienced an intense interest in environmental affairs that we dropped. At least it's off the agenda. Doesn't mean we're not doing anything in the area, it's off the agenda. It's not a matter of much discussion among policymakers anymore, except at the policy subsystem level. Here's a graph of the hearings. This is from the Congress. You can make that graph with two or three keystrokes from all sorts of different data sets. And so it's a very powerful tool for the quick analysis of changes in public policy. That graph, you can't see it very well because I'm on the screen, smaller screen. It starts in 47 and goes through, I think, 2008. It's just the number of hearings that we coded in our policy agendas project as reflecting environmental concerns. So you can see before the 60s, you got almost none, and then an explosion of these, peaking, I think, sometime in the 80s. I can't see the date myself. And then a decline, a definite fall off after we passed a cap and trade bill on some pollutant or another in the early 90s. Mike or Jeremy can tell me very quickly that is. Sulfur dioxide. See, I told you you could. Since then, we've experienced much less number of hearings there. Similarly, this is a graph of laws that affected the environment that were covered by the Congressional Quarterly. This is a way we try to get at more important laws. And you can see there the major environmental legislation have that band that corresponds to the hearings from 1972 to 1992, that 20-year period of intense activity. Not much before then and not much after in terms of the lawmaking process. So this is what I'm trying to isolate, this intense feedback process in which we're interested. Then it disappears from the agenda. We don't talk about it very much. People have puzzled why Barack Obama, who came to power talking a lot about global warming and green jobs, didn't follow up much. He did do some green power incentives, and now has been hammered by Congress on some possible malfeasances, misfeasances at least, in the implementation of those programs. But not much on climate change at all. Crime, a little bit of a different pattern, and I have studied this in more detail, and a fear from my dinner last night, Canada's asking for it by setting off a positive feedback system of a feeding frenzy on putting criminals in jail. And it's what we did in another similar period. Again, this is a little hard to see, but if you... there's a ratchet there in the late 60s and early 70s. What happened in that period? We experienced the urban riots, urban disorders, and you had a lot of federal activity in supporting local law enforcement during that period of time. During the same period of time, our crime rate went up. The crime bubble is associated with a rising crime. It is not true that it was made up of whole cloth. Crime rates went up. Violent crime rates went up even more. Drug use went up in the same period of time. The attention of the public was focused on this. So the New York Times, our measure, and this all came from the Policy Agendas Project, our measure of press coverage increased during this period of time. A lot more coverage of crime. But it's not as if the Times was making it up. The crime rate was going up, and people were becoming more concerned about it. This is important to understand. I'm not postmodern on this. Now, however, when a ratchet occurs like that, I think that ratchet, and that's what we call it in the article we wrote on this, can generate a policy bubble. And it did that in the United States. By the mid-80s, we had a huge bidding war between the Democrats and the Republicans on who was tougher on crime. And we ended up with just a set of really terrible laws not allowing judges discretion on sentencing, lots of severe mandatory sentencing, copies in the states of these bad procedures, and we fill up our prison. Now we got more people in jail than any country in the world. It's a distinction that America prides itself on, more than Russia. Now, if you see leveled off, the dotted line is the I believe that's the concern of the public on crime matters. But there's a leveling off the crime rate, but not of congressional hearings, which is the darkest line there. So the crime rate leveled off. It doesn't go up anymore. But hearings continue to go up. and budgets continue to go up. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that. All it takes is a policy process scholar. We created a crime policy subsystem. And now it feeds in itself in the sense it's got lobbying, got guys from New York and California and Oklahoma and everywhere coming to Washington wanting more money. It's good politics to announce big new crime control grants in the states and so forth. And California did it. The states are busy doing this at the same time. California created a whole new prison industry. So did every other state. But in California, it's just more well-developed. Prison unions and localities. Everybody wants a prison now. I mean, it used to be a terrible thing. Now people want it because it creates good jobs because the prison unions were successful in getting their pay up and they become good middle-class citizens. And so. But you got to have somebody to lock up to do that. There's a second benefit. You can allocate lots of contracts to build private prisons too. Okay. Look at the budget figure. That's the dark line. How it's gone up during that period of time. If you set off a policy bubble, you're going to have results for a long, long period of time. And that's what we're stuck with now. So my piece of advice to candidates, don't follow us on this. Be careful. You're going to spend a lot of money doing this. Probably not going to do that much good. that's a debate among criminologists. I suspect if we had more prisons than we had in 1970, we were well off in the sense of more crime control. But again, like many policy bubbles, we overinvested. Crime laws follow a similar pattern. We don't pass many anymore, but we did through that period of time. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about, before I close, I'm running on a little long, this policy feedback, what is the behavioral foundations of these policy bubbles and positive feedback? Very interesting book by George Akerlof and Robert Shiller, two economists, called Animal Spirits. And they pick out five things they think are important in economic bubbles. Confidence, stories, narratives, myths, we call them, norms and fairness, corruption, bad faith, money illusion. I only want to talk about two of these because I think three of them are not very connected to the psychological literature, which is one of the things we've got to discipline ourselves as social scientists not to do. I love this book, but I think they made up a lot of it. In the sense they didn't know the psychological literature. Okay. Confidence. Humans, there's a good psychological literature to show that humans tend to be overconfident, and men are worse about it than women. Why do women always make better decision makers in these psychological experiments than men? Because men got way too much faith that they know what they're doing. You women know that. So just push aside those women. They know what they're talking about. Push aside these other guys, this advice. No, I know what I'm doing. And that usually leads to policy bubbles. The narratives are important, and I've never thought a lot about narratives. We all know Deborah Stone's work on causal stories as part of explanations of public policy. It's brilliant stuff. There's a lot of work now in psychology, mental models, and it's something that Lynn Ostrom has picked up as an important part of her work. And she says mental models are affected by feedback from the world and shared culture or belief systems in which an individual is embedded. It's in our head and outside, and that's important. That's an important part of this. So narratives, overconfidence, motivated reasoning, and mimicking. And motivated reasoning I'm going to talk a little bit about. There's lots of debate about whether heuristic rules are adaptive or not. I'm inclined to think yes, they are, both adaptive and not, depending on the circumstances. But there's a big debate there. But there's a lot less study in organizations about higher level cognitive processes and its role in mistake. Higher level cognitive processes means we start thinking about it. Herb Simon thought the more you thought about it, the more adaptive your behavior is. We no longer accept that because we can see people thinking through all sorts of things with preconceived notion of what they're going to find, and it feeds into itself. If you look at people in the United States who think global warming is real and humans did it, there's a big difference between Democrats and Republicans. But if you look at college educated among Democrats, more people, more higher percentage accept global warming. If you look at Republicans, less do. Why? Motivated reasoning, they're smarter, they can give themselves all sorts of reasons why something happens. Now, you can find plenty of cases in which that's reversed. Democrats self-reinforce ideas are not so good. I picked that one because I often get depressed about our inability in the United States to even talk sensibly about this. So motivated reasoning and policy narratives go together. So you're motivated to find in information confirmations of what you already believe. That's higher processing. You're not thinking through the problem, actually resistant to addressing the problem. Policy narratives, you can tell yourself stories about why that's the case, of why a market will solve all problems in life, or why a government will, why the market never can. Those are all narratives. I almost always have an element of truth, but are oftentimes wrong in the details. All right. We need to understand this idea of motivated reasoning and policy narratives a lot better than we do. We need to understand their role in feedback effects. We need to understand how it is that these positive feedback effects change policymaking enormously in a very brief period of time, and then you're stuck with it all for a very, very long period of time. But I want to close with one summary concept in dealing with some of these implications. That's disproportionate information processing. We need a summary concept, and I find this one useful. Relative to the implications for action stemming from information coming in from the world and Ostrom's feedback from the world, humans are disproportionate information processors. What I mean by that is they display a clear pattern of underreacting and then overreacting. We can't stop ourselves from it because of our psychological makeup, as well as the organizations we're embedded in. So if you're not paying attention to something and it changes on you, and when you shift to address the problem, you're already behind. If the organization acts, or motivated reasoning, or who you talk to in your group acts to limit your span of action, the gap gets larger. You could even probably make a rational model that would lead to over and under reaction. It'd be very small compared to what we observe in human life. And the behavioral, each of the behavioral mechanisms, I won't do this today, I'll leave it for your homework. Each behavioral mechanism that I've talked about has implications for both sides, both overreaction and underreaction. Motivated reasoning can lead you to do nothing because things are fine, or it can lead you to panic, and then the other side gains the hand and they're put over selling. So each of these behavioral mechanisms has its analog at the organizational level. A few final thoughts that you can find in all sorts of elements of the literature. Benoit Mandelbrot, the inventor of fractal, said, man tends to react either by overestimation or neglect. Looks like disproportionate information processing. My favorite, Tom Kolegoris, who's a Republican lobbyist who ended up being appointed to an ambassadorship in Belgium. I have great confidence in him based on this statement. The things Congress does best are nothing and overreacting. The phenomenon of inattention and neglect on the one hand and urgency and mobilization and action on the other has profound consequences for human affairs. It can cause changes in how we view simple objects in the world. Remember the train coming out. It can cause changes in how we view simple objects in the world, booms and busts in stock markets, and outbursts of policy actions by government. Thanks for listening to all this.